chapter 31, where we have the first steps in God bringing back Jacob to the land of Canaan. And we've had the two factors that were involved. The first one is in verses 1 and 2, which was the animosity that had developed between Jacob and the sons of Laban and Laban himself, animosity over the wealth that he had accumulated. And then coupled with the animosity of man is the command of God in verse 3 that he leave and go back to the land of Canaan. And we made the observation in the first session of what do you think might have happened if things hadn't gone sour in Mesopotamia? And I think the answer to that is fairly obvious. He would probably still be sitting in Mesopotamia. And it shows that God often lets things fall apart on us so things can really fall together for the best. And now Jacob is pulling together Leah and Rachel, and they're making preparation for the trip. And we noted his speech is about two things. It's about life in Mesopotamia, which takes us down into this section, verses 4 through 9, and then he's going to talk about a dream that he had in Mesopotamia. We said, first of all, that the theme is the treatment of Laban and the blessing of God, and so that in these verses, you can put down what Laban did in one column, and you can counterbalance it with what God did. And you have the section, verses 4 and 5. Verse 4 reads, Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to his flock in the field and said, I see your father's attitude that is not friendly toward me as formerly. So 5a is what Laban did, and 5b is, but the God of my father has been with me. That's what God did. Then you come back for a second cycle in verse 6. You know that I serve your father with all my strength. Your father has cheated me, changed my wages 10 times. However, God did not allow him to hurt me. So 7a is what Laban did. 7b is what God did. And then you have another cycle coming down in verses 8 and 9. If he spoke thus, the speckle shall be your wages. The he would be a reference to Laban. Then all the flock brought forth speckle. And if he, Laban, spoke thus, then the stripe shall be your wages, then all the flock brought forth stripe. And verse 8 then is what Laban did, and verse 9 says, thus God has taken away all your father's livestock and given them to me, and verse 9 is what God did. So you have a series of contrasts between the treatment of God and the treatment of Laban in the context. When you come down to the speech that opens up in verse 5, you have some important opening words. Verse 5 says that he, Jacob, said to them, that is his wives, I see. And the word I see has two important features with it. Number one, it is a participle indicating continuous action. So he's simply saying this, this is not an isolated case. I have seen over and over and over again. Also, it's emphatic. And so he is simply saying, ladies, I want to set in front of you my observations. I want you to know what I have most certainly seen and what is not an isolated case at all. When you come down to verse 6, verse 6 opens with an emphatic pronoun. And it's the pronoun you. And you, that is, along with me, know that I've served your father with all my strength. In other words, he is making two important points about Laban, and the two important points about Laban are as follows. He is saying his dislike is proven. That's the opening participle. I see. Continuous action. It's proven. And his dishonesty is persistent. And those are the two things that he appeals to Rachel and Leah about concerning their father. The proven dislike, the persistent dishonesty on the part of Laban. Now, when in verse 7, your father has cheated me, changed my wages 10 times, we ought to keep in mind who's speaking this. This is a Jacob. And Jacob knew how to cheat. And he knew how to be dishonest. That was part of his name. That was part of his nature. He had done it before. So I take it then, verse 7, is indicating that Jacob hasn't quite yet seen himself. Because, what do we say inconsistently? It's the pot calling the kettle black? Blind to himself. Interesting little historical note. Robert Burns, who was laureate poet of Scotland, as you know, it's a good illustration of not really seeing yourself like you are. And the record indicates that this illustrates how often we don't understand context. He was sitting beside a very elegant society lady in church, very conscious of her manicured look, her clothes, her position in the community. And as he was sitting behind her, he noticed an insect crawling up the back of her dress toward her collar. And he took out his pen and he wrote. Anyone know? Something, you know it, but you haven't put it in the context of a bug crawling up a lady's back. Oh, that God the grace would give us to see ourselves as others see us. Illustrates context, doesn't it? You've heard that little quote before, but probably thought it came out of a profound meditation session. Instead, it was a bug crawling up a lady's back. At any rate, his first part of his speech, then, is about life in Mesopotamia, the bad treatment of Laban, the good treatment of God. Second, his speech is about his dream in Mesopotamia. And the dream comes down to verse 10. It says, it came about at the time when the flock were mating that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream. And behold, the male goats which were mating were striped, speckled, and mottled. Then the angel of God said to me in the dream. It's important to note that the angel of God in this context in verse 11 is identified as an angel. But that same being, if you notice down in verse 13, assumes the prerogative of God. Because in verse 13, that angel says, I am the God of Bethel. And so apparently, we've got another pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. Verse 11, the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob, and he said, Ah, here I am. And he said, Lift up now your eyes, see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. And God is simply saying that I'm sovereign over their mating. That's important. Last time we studied in chapter 30 how that Jacob goes through this routine of setting rods in front of the cattle. And it appears that he thought that this method worked. But when we come over to chapter 31, find out that that had nothing to do with it. It was the hand of God that caused his flocks to be multiplied. And therefore, he emphasizes to his wives two things, his prosperity in verse 12, his prospects in verse 13. When God speaks and says, I'm the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me, now arise, leave this land, return to the land of your birth. With that, you get the response of Rachel and Leah, and as we said last time, this is, as far as the text is concerned, the first time these two sisters ever agree on anything. And they do, verse 14. Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, Do we still have any portion of inheritance in our father's house? Are we not reckoned by him as foreigners? For he sold us, and he has entirely consumed our purchase price. Surely all the wealth which God has taken away from our father belongs to us and our children. Now then, do whatever God has said to you. And again, that's probably the first time that Rachel and Leah get together and say, Jacob, do the will of God. And that's the way the verses close. One other thing we might say about them is there's a little important psychology in 14 through 16. In the earlier verses, Jacob talks about what Laban had done to him. And now they are concluding what Laban will probably do to us. And that rests on a premise. If Laban would cheat you, he would also cheat us. That's a handy little piece of psychology in life, by the way. to keep in mind that if someone else talks to you about someone else, why wouldn't they talk to someone else about you? Or in this context, if they would cheat in one place, why not would they do it in another? So we now have got the execution of the departure, verse 17. Then Jacob arose, put his children and his wives upon camels, drove away all his livestock, all his property which he had gathered. He acquired livestock which he had gathered in Paddan Aram to go to the land of Canaan to his father Isaac. When Laban had gone to share his flock, then Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. Now keep in mind, Jacob has no idea that she did this. She steals the household gods. The household gods are called teraphim. I think you've got that in your margin. Rachel stole the teraphim. What do we know about the teraphim? Number one, they are idols. And we do know this, that the teraphim are found in every period of Israel's history. The teraphim are found in every period of Israel's history. They are always condemned. Some of the great revivals in Israel's history is when they put away the teraphim, when they put away the idols. They are always and they're consistently condemned. We also know that they were linked to divination. They were linked to divination. Divination had to do with determining things about the future, what is going to happen, what is going to occur, what is the will of God. Divination is the counterpart to written revelation. Divination is the counterpart to divine revelation. Or we really ought to say it is the pagan counterpart to divine revelation, whereby God in the Old Testament revealed himself in his word. And the counterpart to that was divination that the pagan nations practiced. And here, in the house of Laban, you have the teraphim. This illustrates also another fact, that the teraphim caused great attachment. Laban loved his teraphim, and he was terrified. Attachment. He was terrified when they were lost. Notice down, for example, at chapter 31, verse 26. Jacob said to Laban, "What have you done by deceiving me, carrying away my daughters and the captives with the sword? Why did you flee secretly, deceive me, and did not tell me?" And so forth. "Did not allow me to tell my sons and daughters goodbye." And however, you come down to verse 30, which is the climactic point. "And now you have indeed gone, because you long greatly for my father's house." And here is the climax point. "Why did you steal my gods?" And that is the thing about which he is most concerned. He is fanatically attached to it. And so he's simply saying, "You took my daughters, but you did worse. You took my teraphim." Well, as he has departed, we now have part two, the pursuit of Laban. The pursuit. 31:22-25. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, then he took his kinsmen with him, pursued him a distance of 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the hill country of Gilead. Now here's the significant thing that happens, a very important thing that happens. It says, God came to Laban the Aramean. Notice, by the way, he's identified now as Laban the Aramean. He is no longer a relative. This is going to be severed. In a dream that night, and said, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob, either good or bad." Now, what does that mean? What does do not speak good or bad mean. What does it mean when he says, do not speak good or bad? The meaning of that phrase is this. Don't say anything to make him change his mind. Say nothing to influence or seek to influence Jacob to return. In other words, he's saying to Laban, I do not want you to attempt to influence this man. Don't seek to change his mind by threatening him, saying, I will annihilate you if you don't come back with me. Don't say anything good. Don't say, now if you come back to Paddan Aram, back to Mesopotamia, here's some of the good things that I will agree to do for you. So don't seek to change his mind by a threat. That would be bad. Do not seek to change his mind by a promise. That would be good. Do not seek in any way to say that. Laban had said those words once. Go back to chapter 24. And the context is Isaac has sent his servant down to seek a wife for Isaac, or Abraham has sent his servant down to seek a wife for Isaac. And you recall the circumstances as they work out, and you come down to verse 48. Servant says, I bowed low, worshiped the Lord, blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. Speaking to Laban now. So now, if you're going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. And if not, let me know that I may turn to the right hand or the left. In other words, you've got to make a decision about the marriage of Rebekah. And Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the matter comes from the Lord. In other words, God has obviously led. So we cannot speak to you bad or good. And what are they really saying? They're simply saying the will of God is fixed. God has spoken. He's arranged the circumstances. And we can do nothing whatsoever to alter it. Now, God is going to say again to Laban, don't you do anything to seek to try to influence Jacob at all. So he pursues him. And this will become very much a theme that Laban knows he is bound when he meets him with our third part, or the confrontation. The confrontation. The confrontation takes place in verses 36 through 42. And we start out with Laban's complaint. Verse 26. Then Laban said to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me, carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? We ought to note at this point that Jacob and Laban are now confirmed enemies. This will never change. They are now confirmed enemies. And part of the evidence in saying that is the militaristic terms that you've got. For example, go back to 22, verse 22. When it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob had fled, and the fleeing is a term that's used in connection with the movement of an army. Verse 23, then he took his kinsmen with him and he pursued. And the term pursued is a term used of the pursuit of an army. Militaristic terms. Verse 26, Laban said to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Captives of the sword is very much a military term. So that they're now absolutely confirmed enemies. Now, one thing we ought to add is often a confirmed enemy plays other roles. And Laban is not going to play the role of an enemy. He is not going to shake his fist in the face of Jacob. He's going to play the role of a crushed father. And so you come down then in the context, verse 27, 28, and these words are really hollow. If you fought in the life of Laban, you know how much nonsense is here. Why did you flee secretly, deceive me, did not tell me, so that I might have sent you away with joy, and with songs, and with timbrel, and with lyre? You did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. And so the role he will play is hurt father. So they're confirmed enemies, but Laban plays the role of the hurt father. He's been crushed. I would have made it nice for you. Of course, that all rings very hollow because it's all very false. Now, when you come down to his little speech here, and you look at verse 30, you do have a first. Verse 30 says, "And now you have indeed gone away because you long greatly for your father's house." In other words, Laban is saying, your conduct up to this point of time, I can understand it. You know, I can see you'll want to go to your father's house. I can understand that. But there's something I cannot understand. And that is, why did you steal my gods? And with the word gods, you have the first mention of pagan gods in the Old Testament. This is the first mention of pagan gods. First place in Scripture. They have a tenacious grip on Laban. It's interesting. Just to illustrate what a grip idolatry has, and I realize idolatry is a little hard for us to understand in the sense of having an image, being attached to it, worshiping it, but human history is filled with idolatry, and it's a thing that grasps man probably more firmly than any other thing. For example, Laban had met God the night before. Go back to verse 24. God came to Laban the Aramean in a dream of the night and said to him, "Be careful that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad." Notice the basic fundamental difference between the teraphim and God. Is the true God is self-revealing and spoke. So Laban had met a God that talked to him, but he is still attached to his gods, and the comparison is obvious. The gods of Laban could be stolen, packed with pots and pans and stuffed in a sack. As a matter of fact, at the moment in this scene, Rachel is sitting on God in her saddlebag. And Laban cries out, "Where are my gods?" And they replied, "We're over here in the saddlebag underneath Rachel on our heads." Well, they could not communicate. This is the folly of idolatry. Now, I meant to put into that a tone of ridicule, because if we do not speak of teraphim and the pagan gods with ridicule, we're not reflecting the tone of Scripture. We sang this morning, "Amazing Grace." If we were in Israel, we could have very well turned to a hymn this morning and sung, "Let's sing about the dumb gods, the stupid gods of the pagan nations." Go to Psalm 135. And you're going to the hymn book of Israel. And part of their hymnody were songs ridiculing and making fun of the gods of the pagan. Suppose you had been a pagan, you were attached to your gods, you worship your gods, you love your gods, and you were just down the coastline from Israel, enough that when something went on in Jerusalem, you could hear the goings on. And when the nations sang together, you could hear their songs. And here you were in a context of pagan gods, and the nation of Israel is singing a morning hymn. And here's the way they read. Verse 14. The Lord will judge His people, will have compassion on His servants. The idols of the nations are but silver and gold, the work of man's hands. They have mouths, but they don't speak. They have eyes, but they do not see. They have ears, but they don't hear. Now, nor is there any breath at all in their mouths. Those who make them will be like them. Yes, everyone who trusts in them. And that's just an insult. They are deaf, dumb, and blind. And hey, you pagans, you're deaf, dumb, and blind too. You're stupid because you do not know the God of Israel. And so ridicule of the pagan gods was part of the fabric of the nation of Israel. And let's go back to Genesis 31. All right, Rachel has stolen the teraphim. And we need to ask and answer another question, and that is this. Why would Rachel want the teraphim? Why would Rachel want the teraphim? Why did she take them? What did she want with them? Well, we know several things about the teraphim and the gods that is significant. First of all, we know that they were thought to produce fertility. They were thought to produce fertility. Archaeology has turned up a lot of the teraphim. Basically, they were nude goddesses with accented sexual features. Last night it just dawned on me that with a high-speed copier, a lot of the pictures you see in archaeology, we could hand them out. And I called Jane. I said, "Do you think it'd be a good idea just to run off some of the maps and so forth, which we're going to be doing because it's so easy to do now, so you can have them in your hands?" And I had a whole page there of teraphim, and I thought, "Well, that's probably not a very good place to begin," so we didn't. But nonetheless, they are nude goddesses with the sexual features are emphasized on them, and that was because they were thought to produce fertility. So why did she swipe the teraphim? She wanted to have more babies. And consequently, because of that, she thought probably that this would be the case. There's a second reason. When you go to the Nuzu texts of that time, show a link between the teraphim and your inheritance, so that the sons would pick up the father's inheritance based on possession of the teraphim. So it's perhaps in her mind that if there's any inheritance left back down there, then we need to have the teraphim so we can cash in on them. Well, this is followed by Jacob's response. Laban's tirade, Jacob's response. And in his response, he focuses on his fear and his offer. First, his fear, verse 31. Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid. For I said, lest you would take your daughters from me by force." So Jacob is saying, "I left because I was afraid. I was acting out of fear." Notice, by the way, there's no reference to God's command. Jacob could have answered and said, "I left because God commanded me to go back to the land." Apparently he feels that Laban will not identify with this and consequently does not mention. He says, "I was simply afraid, and it was out of fear that I left." Verse 31. Along with his fear, he makes an offer. His offer is in verse 32. Now keep in mind, he doesn't know that Rachel has stolen the teraphim. basically when you read about Jacob and Esau and Laban and Rachel and Leah, you can always assume that none of them know what the other is doing to them. But they're always doing something. And so with verse 32, he doesn't know that Rachel has swiped the teraphim. And he says, "The one with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. This probably, by this time in human history, the Code of Hammurabi was several centuries old. And in that law code, there was a part that said, if anyone steals from the temple or from the gods, they shall be put to death. And so it's very possible that he's reflecting what that code had said, and therefore Rachel knew what was going on. She heard this, and Rachel is going to have to do some fast thinking. But she's been to a good school. I mean, Laban was daddy, and he was good at maneuvering. Jacob was husband, and he was good at it too. So she had some experience, and therefore she's going to have to do some quick thinking, or she's going to be dead Rachel. Well, this is followed by Laban's search of the goods, 33 through 35. Verse 33, "So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent." And you know, Rachel, her mind was going 100 miles an hour. She's got to figure out something to do or I'm going to be dead. "And into the tent of the two maids, but did not find him. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent." Now, Rachel had taken the household idols, the teraphim, and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. And Laban felt through the tent, but did not find them. So her first step is, let's scrounge these things away. I'll put them in my saddlebags, and I'll sit on them. But, you know, Laban could always say, "Get up on your feet. Let me look in those saddlebags." But Rachel is a pretty good little deceiver. And she comes in, verse 35, and said to her father, "Let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me." So he searched, but did not find the household idols. We tried to identify firsts in Genesis. This may be the first case of a woman justifying her actions by PMS. At any rate, she utilizes that to say, "I can't get up, it's my period." And there women will do that, won't they? Well, let's, okay. Not going to touch that. Go on. Apparently, there's a little more to it than that, however, that Laban probably never dreamed that a woman in her condition would contaminate his gods in the legislation of Leviticus. Listen, I'm serious now. In the legislation of Leviticus 15, during her menstrual period, a woman couldn't come to the shrine. She was unclean as far as worship was concerned. So this could well be sort of a little mini illustration of Israel's contempt for idolatry. So to save her life, so ladies, you can make use of that device if you need to in life to save your hide. Okay. B. Jacob's contention. And basically his argument is going to have a basic argument and a basic conclusion. And his argument is going to be, as I've given you 20 years of meticulous service, I've been honest, and all you've rewarded me with is tricks and deception. Verse 36, "Then Jacob became angry and contended with Laban." Actually, the term contended is a word that means to punch a hole in. Apparently, Jacob became so angry that he wanted to punch a hole in somebody. And doubtless Laban contended with Laban, and Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my transgression? What is my sin? Why have you hotly pursued me?" And notice his breakdown then is in three ways. Number one, I have been unjustly pursued. Number one, I've been unjustly pursued. 2, I have been falsely charged. These are the things that he contends Laban has done to him. I've been falsely charged, and I have been repeatedly cheated. And those are the three things that he focuses on. Unjustly charged, verse 36. What is my transgression? What is my sin? Why have you hotly pursued me? Falsely charged, 37 through 40. Repeatedly cheated, 41 and 42. Verse 41, these 20 years I've been in your house. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction, the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. With that, you have the final part, or the proposal of the treaty. First, it is proposed in verse 43. Laban answered and said to Jacob, and notice, no amount of reason, no amount of argument can ever change a jealous mind. He has pointed out everything, or Jacob's pointed out that I've lost sleep over your sheep. I've never lost one. I've never taken one. If one has lost, I have supplied one to replace it. And you would think the logic coming out of this, like 41 and 42, would have convinced him. But notice verse 43, Laban is jealous, and you do not logically argue against jealousy. It's irrational. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. The flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters, which are the children whom you have born? So now come, let us make a treaty, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. And with the following context, Jacob goes along with it. They make the treaty. They set up the sign of it, the stone. Verse 45, Jacob took a stone, set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to the kinsmen, gather the stones. So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Laban called it in Aramaic, Jeger Sahadatha, which means heap of witness. Jacob called it Galeed, Hebrew for heap of witness. And Laban said, the heap is a witness between you and me this day. Therefore they named it Galeed and Mizpah, and said, here is probably one of the most taken out of context verses ever. I remember in high school, grade school, being in a church where at the end of the service, the pastor would raise his hand and say, may the Lord watch between you and me while we are absent one from the other. Boy, it's as though, may God take care of you and take care of me until we joyously gather together once again next Sunday. You know what verse 49 means? He's saying, may God watch between you and me so we won't kill one another. Now that may be a good benediction for the church, you know. May God watch between you, sister, and you, brother, so you won't kill one another before we get back again next week. But that's the theme of it. In fact, the words in absent from one another, really in Hebrew, read, when we can't keep an eye on one another. I mean, these are two rascals that are at one another's throat. So when we can't keep an eye on one another, may God keep us apart, but because God doesn't keep it apart, I'm going to choke you to death. And that's the idea of it. So don't say that verse with a nice little, may the Lord watch between you and me. It's, may God keep us from killing one another is the context of that verse. And so the boundary, the heap is set up. It's a boundary marker. Verse 50, the conditions of it, if you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives beside my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. It's very interesting in this treaty. Jacob is made out to be the one that has to be watched. Martin Luther has an interesting comment. He says, the undependable man is trying to make the dependable one appear undependable. And that's exactly the thrust that you've got in this particular context. And with that, the treaty is signed, and in our terms is signed. And in verse 54, Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain, called his kinsmen to the meal. They ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. So for him, it was a feast of thankfulness. It was goodbye to the past. And of course, for Laban in verse 55, early in the morning, Laban rose, kissed his sons and daughters, blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. And with that verse, the last sentence of verse 55, he passes out of the life of Jacob and out of God's book, never to be mentioned again. Closing observations on this whole thing. Obedience to the commands of God. Obedience to the commands of God secures the protection of God. Obedience to the commands of God secures the protection of God. And that's the way the chapter started out. That was the theme. You do what I tell you, I will be with you. And that is a principle. Second, when we come into this treaty, Jacob is in a really conciliatory spirit. And that has a principle. He did not need to be watched. He wasn't going to attack Laban. And he could have taken a very self-righteous attitude. Laban, I'm not going to touch you. I'm not going to go through any treaty with you of non-aggression. Well, there's a principle there. Concessions are not always compromises. Concessions are not always compromises. Compromises in a bad sense of the word. Third observation. Jacob and Laban were the same, except for one point. Jacob encountered God. Bethel is the difference. They were both liars. They were both deceivers. They were both dishonest. But Jacob had met God. Fourth and finally, no man is truly promoted until he is promoted by God. Jacob will be promoted to Canaan, but he was put there by God, and that is true success and true promotion. Father, we're thankful for this, your word, in Christ's name. Amen.